Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 24th, 2006. Our session today is titled Stranded in the Savannah: Cross-Cultural Encounters. Our presenter is Mwenda Natarangwi. Session number NTM 2006-1. Let's listen in.
You good? Are you recording?
Yes, it's good. Started.
All right. Well, welcome, folks. My name is Mwenda Natarangwi. I have it over there because I know it takes a mouthful for somebody who's not trained to pronounce consonants following each other, especially at the beginning of the word. And I'm an anthropologist. I teach cultural anthropology. And one of the things that I thought about when Paul Olson invited me to be here is to talk about culture. There's this myth that we are all becoming the same, that we have globalization, and so we become the same, so we'll have one culture. And if you've seen over time that the more we tend to think we're becoming the same, the more we become resistant to other things. It is okay to be the same as long as you have access to other cultures. But when it comes to their culture changing ours so that we can become like them, then it's a big issue. So we're not really becoming the same. We're just becoming much more aware of what other people have and what we can get from them. And sometimes they can get a little from us. And I like to talk about this because I believe that 70% of our problems are cultural misunderstandings. And the rest we can take care of. So I have entitled my topics Cross-Cultural Encounters, because we really encounter other cultures. We are all cultural beings. And as a cultural anthropologist, I'm always interested in asking specific questions. What makes us unique as human beings? And what happens when we encounter another culture? And when we think of, we don't have to think of two very exotic cultures coming together. Think of a family. I mean, you go visit a family and you find they have dishes from last night and the night before and the other night before. In the sink, and you're saying, "What kind of family is this?" You know, because they're used to cleaning up your dishes immediately after you eat. But in their culture, in their family, that's not a priority. You know, or you find pizza boxes in the living room, or socks on top of the TV, and you say, "What kind of culture is this? Who lives here?" Because you are judging their room according to how you keep yours. Mm-hmm. You know, and then probably they'll come to your room and say, "Do people ever use things here? Everything is so neat." So we all have, we're coming from a different orientation, and so I like to ask, what happens when we encounter another culture? Not necessarily going to a very different country in another culture where they speak a different language, but even within families. Mm-hmm. You know, so these are the things that I think would be useful for us as people who are interested in change and positive change, is to first of all ask ourselves, what is it that makes us unique? And I tend to think it's our culture. You know? Because everything else we know from biology, that we have the same DNA and all that. So really, it's not really that you're very different. But it's the way we view our world, the way we've been trained to taste, smell, imagine, create, all those things, which are very, very specific to where we grew up and how we grew up, that become sometimes a hindrance, sometimes a very positive thing for us. And how do cultures change? Because there is always this, at least in the earlier times, the thinking that culture is the hindrance. I mean, if you read, for those of you interested in development, if you read texts on development from the 70s, 80s, culture was always the hindrance. How can we get rid of this culture so that we can develop? Assuming that development is itself uncultural, that is acultural, it doesn't have a culture. But if you want to change from the way you live now to another way, guess what? That's also cultural, because it is a way of life. You're going to eat different foods, you're going to produce foods differently, because that's how we do as human beings. And why do cultures change? They constantly change. In the example I gave of in a house where you find dishes from 3 days, 3 nights ago, still in the sink, waiting for somebody to wash them. Imagine one of the people married from that home into the super neat home. there'll be some compromise, and there'll be some cultural change. This person will say, you know what? Okay, one night is the max. Okay? And the other person will say, you have to remove the plastic from the chairs. Let's sit on the chairs that were meant to be sat and not to be seen. And then you will say, okay, we'll compromise. We'll remove from the four that we always use. We'll leave two. So you compromise, and then changes your worldview. It changes the way you think of things. Let me tell you what anthropologists consider to be culture. It's patterns of economy. How you produce what you consume, how you sell it, how you organize it. It is a social organization. How do people live? There are families where if you get married, you all live in the same unit. Mostly in North America, in the U.S. When you get married, you want to go far away from anybody else so that people can come and visit. And also in the belief systems. Many cultures have something in common among its people. It's the belief systems, what they believe in. And culture is learned. Nobody is programmed to be this kind of a cultural being. You learn it. You could be born of English parents, and you're raised in India, and you'll have Indian mannerisms, as long as that's the first contact culture you have. And also, it's shared. For us to be able to sustain our culture, it has to be shared. I know a lot of people, especially young people, say, I'm my own person. I do my own thing. But if you really dig deep, they are responding to something cultural in their own context. They're doing this because they don't want to be that. So your frame of reference is still your cultural realm. So you're not really being yourself. Because if you are yourself, who will make meaning of what is important to you? How do you decide what is meaningful? How do you decide what is fashion? If nobody ever cared about how you look, you go walk into a room and nobody says a thing to you, nobody even notices you, it'll be a very different experience for the person who thinks they're an individual. So we all respond to stimuli from our own cultural beliefs. And it's also traditional knowledge. And this is where there's always this cultural clash between people who are older and people who are younger. Because we want them to learn the things we learned, because we still cherish them. When I was growing up, I used to do this and this and this. And the younger people say, well, that was your time. My time is this. So this shared, it's learned, but also passed down from generation to generation. And although generally stable over time, culture is also very flexible, very fluid. Sometimes people revert to old traditions when they find they have lost the identity of who they are. Right now, among many migrant communities in this country, there is almost a renewal, it's almost a renaissance of their own cultural roots. Kids who have been born here have never had any roots in their parents' country are finding this. So they are redefining themselves to become that which they think will be acceptable to them and their own group. So it is also very flexible, fluid, always constantly changes, always boring, inventing, very creative. Well, as I said, as an anthropologist, anthropology always focuses on culture. Whether it is human culture, how we are very different because of our cultures, or how we are so similar. Because basically, if you look deep down, all human beings have a very shared outlook to life. They want to be accepted. They want to live a good life. They want to influence. They want to have some influence in society. And they want to survive long enough. You know, so, and you can find many ways of doing that. We also believe that other societies deserve to be studied and understood without prejudice. They should be judged by our own standards. That is a belief, but in real practical terms, when you see a new word, for instance, if you see my name there, what is the first thing you think of if you pronounce it the way, you know, using your own linguistic frame? You know, if it is a vowel, you pronounce it according to your own training. So we come with a culture that almost betrays our encounter with another. And we try to avoid what is now almost like a taboo thing, ethnocentrism. You want to be accepting, want to be able to say, okay, well, in that context, I understand it. In a way, what I try to do when I'm teaching my students in any anthropology course, I'm trying to allow them to see a different culture from the inside and to see their culture from the outside. Because that is the most important thing you can do. When someone else talks about your culture, if you read about what other people say about you, then you start realizing, really, do I do that? Do I have problems with personal space? You know? Do I like to, you know, to have my own space and mention that you can't come too close? And then you realize this is something. And if you go to a culture where there's a lot of holding hands and, you know, very close proximity, when you're talking to somebody, you're this close, you start feeling uncomfortable. You ask, why am I uncomfortable? And you're seeing all the other people happy and they're, you know, what's wrong? Then you realize that's when you start seeing your culture from outside. But also when you want to see another culture, you step inside, ask, what is it that makes them tick? You know, the old adage, you have to walk before you can condemn a person, you have to walk 50 miles in their shoes. Mm-hmm. You know, just from inside, how do you learn what they're feeling, what they're doing from the inside? Now, one of the things that we tend to do is something called the paradox of culture. You know, we learn to accept our own cultural beliefs and values. And then unconsciously, we learn to reject other cultural beliefs and values. Because ours gives us a roadmap to operating and interacting with our culture. You know how to say hello, you know how to eat, you know what to eat, and when to eat it, who to eat it with. That becomes your realm. Now, if you go to another place where they... their biggest meal is breakfast. And they have fish and spaghetti and greens and all that. In the morning at 7, you're like, what's wrong with these people? You know? Because you are trained to think, you know, cereal, toast, eggs. That is your values. And in a way, you are taught to reject anything else that would step aside from that which you're used to. So that if you find people eating a big meal in the morning, you're wondering, why? But there's nothing in cereal that says it has to be eaten at 7 o'clock. There's nothing physiological, there's nothing biological that says you cannot have cereal for dinner. It's just cultural. You consider it to be light. What if you had a big, like 17 bowls of cereal in the morning? That's big, you know? You can have soup with it, you can have all kinds of things with it. You've been trained that is the sequence you use, you know. And why do we have to have breakfast at 7? Is that when the enzymes are ready to digest the food? Why not have it breakfast at 10, lunch at 4, and dinner at midnight? What would be different? Would we grow shorter? It's probably because of the time schedules, because you have to be at work at 8, you know, and all the way, it's synchronized with all other things in our culture that say, this is what you need to do. You know, you could have breakfast at 10 if you wanted to. If your work schedule started at 11, you know, and you work 5 hours a day for full pay, that would be wonderful. Then you go home for dinner and you have time, all that. So we have nothing really to say that this is specific to our physiology. It is cultural. And unconsciously, we reject other cultural practices that do not fit our mode. And I say, at birth, we are capable of absorbing any culture, any language. There's a joke about an English couple that wanted to adopt a Chinese baby. And the first thing they did is, you know, you prepare. First thing they did, they say they were going to learn Chinese. Because they assumed that a Chinese baby comes programmed to learn Chinese. You know? If it's a baby and there's no language that she or he or she has already acquired, will speak English like an English person. You know? It is only when you use it as a second language, then it becomes something as of a challenge. But we are all predestined, we are all programmed to language, to culture. And you see, a lot of you, if you've dealt or worked with migrants, there's always that tension between the children and their parents. The children adapt so quickly into the American lifestyle, and the parents are still holding on to their home culture. And at times, the roles of who has power switch when they have to operate within an American mode, when the children are the ones to translate the culture to the parents and say, you know what, you don't do that. This is what we do. Let me tell you. Let me translate this to you. So you are always ready to adopt another language if you haven't had too much of your own culture. And also, we tend to think other cultures are wrong because they are different from us. But there's something also called cultural relativity. Sometimes there are two extents. There's people who say, my culture is the best. Period. Nothing else counts. And if you want to deal with me, you have to understand my culture and accept it. Then there are others way to the end that say, well, everybody's right according to their own culture. So how do we then have a middle ground? Because we can't say, well, you go ahead, as long as your culture accepts for you to kill people, in your context, in your culture as a ruler, you can kill people. And that's okay, because it's in your culture. What happens? Where do we come in as people who want to make a difference? Where do we come in as people who know that there are people who don't have those choices in that culture that is being killed? And so we tend also to be very careful about cultural relativity. And especially in terms of ideas about human rights, we have to say, yeah, there are some things, like what is happening in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, you know, where people have power and they can take populations out of where they live, kick them out. You know, when do you say, well, it's their own culture, they can do that, or it's in their own territory, we cannot interfere. Because in the eyes of the perpetrator, everything looks right. But what about the victims? We have to think through and say, well, it is not right. There are some things that are not right. And we have to come up and say, okay, we understand to that extent, but we have to agree that this is not acceptable. Genocide is not a cultural thing. It is. I don't think anybody should accept that numbers of people will be killed because of how they look or what they profess or whatever it is. So we have to be very careful about that. We must have certain principles of what guides us as human beings. We have to have certain principles of how much can you destroy even from the environment. Can we say, yeah, you can go ahead, and, you know, it's your land, you bought it. You can destroy it. You know, you can put mines all over. I was in Mozambique this summer, and they've gone through a very tough time And I think Mozambique could be one of the few countries with the most mines. So a woman will be tilling her land without knowing, and she'll just step on it, a mine, and she'll die. You know? So how do we deal with that? Because that's unacceptable.
Is there still the problem in Mozambique with the mines that were carried away by the flood several years ago and ended up someplace with
where they
fields
were
never been mined, but now they're there as a hazard.
And even though it takes, I don't have the statistic, but it takes so much money to just clear one square foot of land with a lot of mines. I mean, that is unacceptable in any culture, that you could risk the lives of people who have nothing to do with what you're fighting for. And so, my topic was, we are stranded in savannah. And this is what I want to do. We have this notion that culture is the thing we have. Now, I want to give you a story, and we want to think about it, and then we'll handle it as best as we can. Let's imagine all of us are on a safari. Okay? You've heard about safaris in the sun and driving big air-conditioned vans and you're watching wildlife, you know. No more Discovery Channel, you're just going to see them. Okay, and we have a local guide. We are on a 5-day tour in the savannah. We want to see the big five. We want to see everything. And some far away, on one morning, the sun is bright. It's beautiful. We just spotted a few giraffes. We're trying to figure out which one is this. And we see somewhere a silhouette of someone looks like a human being under a tree. And so we're curious. You know, this is a wilderness. There's not supposed to be anybody here. So we ask our driver, who speaks, our language and a little bit of local languages, just a bit to just get by, to drive and see what is that, you know. And as we approach, it is a human being. And as you go closer, we realize about a boy who is about 10 to 12 years old. And he's just sitting under a solitary tree, and there's no sight of any other life, human life, as far as our eyes can see, as far as our binocs can see. And so we are human beings, we decide, let's go find out. So three of us, courageous, we step out, and we go in there, and we find the boy. We can't talk his language. But after a while, we realize he's holding his abdomen. And so we ask our driver, come, can you speak at least two words to say what's going on? And we have, out of, struggles, about 5-10 minutes, we realize the boy has acute appendicitis. And he says he has been thrown away from his village because he has an incurable disease, and he has been left to die. They've already performed death rituals. They've sent him away, and so he's just waiting to die. And there we are. He has acute appendicitis. And we are asked, what do you do? So, I want you to have 1 minute to think about what do you do?
Which one is the doctor?
Yeah. Is there a doctor in the family? Exactly.
What do we do? Think of those questions there.
We respond the way our own culture has taught us to respond.
And what would you do?
Call the helicopter and medevac him to the hospital.
Okay.
Or attempt some form of, attempt to save his life.
Attempt to save his life, yes. And how do you do that? Do you ask the boy or?
Cultural imperative.
You ask him?
No, probably not. Because if we asked him, if we were even able to ask him, I would imagine in his culture, his response might be no. So the culture, that's the definitive culture clash that I think that, especially because it's a child, especially because, if it were an adult, especially if it were an older adult, then I think there might be the possibility that we would respect that culture. But I believe that in this North American culture, we would not give that child the decision, and that we would, I think we would rescue.
Okay.
I think that's how I would
think. Anybody else? What would
One analogy, just quickly on what you said, is when we take Jehovah's Witness parents to court to give their children blood transfusions. I have some Jehovah's Witness patients, and I always tell them, that's fine, I will respect you not wanting blood. But, and it doesn't come to this rarely, but it has happened, and the kids need blood transfusions in this country. That's not as big a cultural shift, but it's a pretty big one. We do give them blood transfusions.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm curious about your response, because when I think about our culture, we in terms of dollars spent, save the older person and let the younger people go.
In terms of North America?
Yeah.
I don't know.
In terms of just dollars spent, we spend, you know, billions and billions of dollars keeping older people alive, and when some of that money to help just basic child care for poor young people.
But I don't think that's how people perceive it. I don't think that's how you're... I mean, I think when you're really analytical and you look at it, you come up with that, but I don't think if you ask the average person, they would think that's what they're doing.
We spend a lot of money on neonatal care and on that end of the spectrum. I agree with you totally about social welfare spending, but... in that medical setting, because you really upped the ante when you made it a life or death medical situation.
Yeah. Yes.
It's reminded that Dan Erlander has taught us that in the early church, the Romans would take their babies if they didn't want them and just toss them into a field to die, and that's what the Christians did. They would come, get the babies, and save them. That's how they were known. And so... it seems like that we would have to save this child.
But part of it is, if you save the child, then do you try to introduce the child back into the culture that you have violated?
That's the question.
Or do you take them into your own culture? And 5-10 years ago, I would have not realized that I needed to think farther than what I'd been taught. But, you know, in terms of what it does to the local culture, you know, it introduces this foreign element, someone that they've already released to death, and I don't know what it does to the culture. And do I have the right to mess with the culture? I don't know.
Yes.
And I have a question about that, though, because when you said, the violation of, is it a violation of the culture when the reason the boy has been cast aside and the death rituals have been performed is because they assume he is incurable. And so there's a knowledge that isn't there at that time in that village or wherever it is, that he is curable. And so if he can be cured through a basically simple operation, if it's performed in time, you know, then is that a violation of the culture? I don't necessarily think so, but I don't know. I mean, maybe it is. And even if it is, though, is it wrong? Because you're saving his life. You know, so.
And that goes back to what you said before about genocide. I mean, genocide is unacceptable. And I would say that allowing someone to die when their life can... allowing a child to die when their life can be saved is right up there in that category.
Mm-hmm.
But your example is a response in panic. And that response might be different than if you had time to think.
You were sitting, I mean, we have time to think here.
Right.
You're sitting in and saying, okay, what is the best thing to do? Mm-hmm. And if it is appendicitis, you know.
Time is important.
Time is important here. And the last thing you're thinking about is whether the child will be accepted in their family back or not.
Yeah.
You want to save the life of this child. But there's a fundamental question that if I came and told you this story, you didn't see this child. Okay? Let's remove the child from my immediate context. If you didn't know this child, if I told you of a child right now in Ethiopia, who needs the same care? Would your response be the same as it was when you were on the ground with the child?
No.
Most definitely not.
No.
So again, as human beings, that panic response affects us a lot. We can do so much because of that moment. But if the person is far removed from our immediate context, then we have a lesser response than we would expect. Let's go back to the issue though. Let's go back to, we take the child to the hospital. He's cured. Okay? What do we do?
Yeah.
What do we do with this child?
Well, I think the first thing I would do is would be to try to find some guidance from someone in that country who knew a little bit more about the culture,
mm-hmm.
to find out, you know, I mean, if indeed, you know, to try to find out if his village knew that he was able to be saved,
mm-hmm.
would that change the picture? Would they be willing to accept him back? Or, you know, try to get some sort of cultural guidance from people who live within that culture.
And then where we go from there. I mean, we have to take this all the way to the end, because we are interested in social change, social justice,
mm-hmm.
and all of that. So we talk to people, we ask anybody who might know about this culture, and remember, we don't speak anything. In fact, we are using our guide, and we have very limited time. Are we going to suspend our tour to pursue this? You know, we say, okay, I'm done. I'm not going back home. I'm going to stay here for 6 years. I want to find out about this culture. Highly unlikely. You'll not be changing your plane ticket.
Yeah.
You know, to go find out. But if some people will do that, I don't want to just make a blanket assumption here. Some people do that. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the ramifications would be trying to introduce the boy back in. Then one of the ramifications could be that you will be swamped with parents bringing all of their kids.
Yes.
And I mean, as soon as you go back and say, you know, we were able to save this child.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Here are all of us.
Take all of us, kids.
Here are all.
Yes.
Hear them all.
Then you get overwhelmed.
And then all of a sudden you're sitting there going, you don't have the resources. You have the resources for the one, but not the resources. I mean, personally, in that group, this group, wouldn't have the resources to cure them all.
Yes.
What if we did intervene and the child died? What do we do with the child?
Mm.
We weren't able to save that child.
Well, I thought he was dead anyway.
You take him back and put him back under the bed.
Sewed up nicely and dress him up and place him on this original tree.
We don't know what their culture is. Maybe they do return for that child a week later. Maybe that's part of their culture.
Maybe though.
And the child is gone. And you didn't intervene. They're in a panic now.
Yes.
I think one of the symptoms of our culture is that we drive ourselves crazy with these kinds of questions, because I think it's
given the enormous problems in the world, as individuals, we can only do the best that we can, consistent with the best effort that we can. So if I'm in Kenya, and I come across this kid under a tree, and I manage to get him to have his hospital, you know, his appendix cured, probably this particular person, me, would then, because I'm a social worker, try to find the appropriate social work agency to take the kid over and carry on with my safari. I'd probably do that.
Yeah.
5 years ago, I would have been really guilty about that, and I would have said, come on, baby, we got to adopt this boy. But as you know, I've been working with people who have AIDS. Can't do that anymore. Can't bring home, you know, 2.5 million kids. So finding that limit is something North Americans, I think, have to work on. Mm-hmm.
Now, yes.
I'm listening, and I'm sorry my hearing, I don't hear everything. We don't have any trouble discussing quite rationally cultural differences when they relate to medicine. And we can joke and laugh. As soon as you get into cultures that surround religion, we are dogmatic and we fight and we don't change. And that's where the real world problem is. And we haven't even mentioned that. I didn't see the word anywhere. And I don't know that we can talk about it rationally.
Very good. Yes.
I'd also like to think if the situation was reversed, if it had been one of us that was injured or in a life and death situation, and you know, a group of people from a different culture, not necessarily in Africa or somewhere else, if they had found one of us almost dying, you know, how they would react to that situation. Would they, you know, take us in under their own customs, you know, cultural beliefs and such, and what we would want them to do with us. If we would feel too tied to our own culture to want to go in and save ourselves.
Yeah. What would happen? It's a very interesting scenario. What would happen? Especially if it's in a remote area where we're not very close to a hospital.
Please, would you boil the water?
Would you not assume that I'm already dead?
We cling to life, and I think we would accept anything.
Yeah.
I think, too, that another scenario that could happen is that their culture would not take him back and say that, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that could happen.
Yes.
And then, there again, what do we do? What will his life be like if, you know, maybe we will and have the resources and we'll adopt him and take him home. But 10 years old, they have a lot of culture,
yes.
Cultural things. I mean, there is that aspect, too, to look at it. What is their quality of life or their life going to be like? Will they... I think, too, we got to cling to life, but, you know, life is a process, too. It's a journey.
And when you think about it, if you take that one child, I always think when you see one, there's a number of others that we didn't see. So what happens? And that's when we start getting into whatever response we'll have for that child will have to be tied to the entire culture. Do we want to introduce this cure to something that we have taken care of for ages? Do we introduce it? And if so, how? Is our plan to go to the culture and say, you know what? We found a child. Instead of going back to the child and saying, we've come to the culture, we know that there was a child who was left to die because they had a disease. And we're coming to tell you that the child is alive. You know? And maybe ask, how come? You know, and they say, well, that disease is not really life-threatening. It can be cured. But when we do that, we have to realize that
idea of curing that disease is tied to so many other cultural aspects. Mm-hmm. Are we willing to work with our culture for that change? Because we're saying every culture changes. This is probably one aspect of its change that that will come in quickly. Will it change and accept that appendicitis is curable if they don't have access to the hospital? So that's a major question for them. Okay, it is curable, but really, we lead a very subsistence lifestyle. We don't have any hospital. We have no access to one. Can we then have access to it so that we can accept your idea that this is cure? So we're also talking about many other issues that are coming in. Are we able to provide that? And if so, how long are we going to be part of this culture? Yeah. Or we just cure this kid and just leave?
Get out of
here. Yes.
And I had a situation like that. I worked in Papua New Guinea, and I had a baby that had, it basically was born without an anus. It was a perforated anus. And we were all set. We were going to take the baby into the bigger city in the hospital and get the surgery that we can cure this. And the parents sat down, and we had interpreters, and we talked about it. And the father looked at the mother, and he looked at his six children, and he said, "No, we will take the baby, and we will go home, and the baby will die." Mm-hmm. And he explained it then. He said, "Do you know what will happen to my farms? Do you know what will happen to my children?" And he said, "To go to this city," he said, "I have enemies there." Mm-hmm. And there were just so many issues, just what he said. Mm-hmm. It was such a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to respect that.
But even that is, I think that's really interesting, because the cultural part of what you just described, besides the words, is the fact that your group, was able to understand that because there was a rational explanation.
Right, and they were part of the decision.
That's right. So there was this culturally rationalized choice, something we're really comfortable with. If the guy had said to you, "We're taking the baby home because the north, the star is pointing west,"
right,
that would have been a lot different. Mm-hmm.
That would be one of the belief systems that is talking
about.
Now, then we come to this point where it is not okay to leave that child, and we know the ramifications of saving his life. What do we do? I mean, as people who are interested in change, because a lot of change has occurred in cultures through that kind of a process, where one culture is able to take care of something that another culture is not able to. You know? And that becomes the agent of change. But how far are we willing to be involved in this other culture? And that's always the big if. How far are we willing? And we can bring it to any context. I'm sure there are pastors here. How far are you willing to go to win somebody for Christ? It is easy to give them the track. You know? And the four laws of, you know, how to get saved. Easy. But what if it meant changing your neighborhood? What if it meant moving away from where you live? Because you don't have good access to that community that you want to work with. How much are you willing to shift? Because again, remember, those are two different cultures. Two different socioeconomic cultures. Are you willing to give up your backyard, your lawns, you know, in order to move to this other community where you feel that it will make a difference if you live with that group or with that family? How far do we go? And this is when we say there are people who are willing to take those risks. And it's a very small percentage of us who are willing to make that sacrifice and take that risk and say, oh, you know what? I think this is fulfilling. I want to do this. Very few of us can do that. I can tell you, it will be very hard for me to move from where I am right now. Even if I know, if I went there, my presence will make a difference. It is very hard for me right now because I am set. Remember we started with this culture thing. I like my routine. I like where I live. I like the things I do every day. I like the predictability of what I do. Moving from that means learning a new culture. Getting uncomfortable. Not being in control. Losing charge. But that is where I think Christ wants to take us. If we were willing to make that shift, I can bet the world would be a better place than it is. Have you heard of something called NIMBYism?
Yes.
Not in my backyard. I will do everything for you, but don't come to live where I live. I will do remote control help. You know, far away. You know, stay in your place. I'll help you, but I will not be with you. Because we are uncomfortable moving from where we used to, from our own culture. And when we do that, when we set ourselves out, we always have all these doubts. You know, what if they don't accept me? You know, we're worried about so many things, very cultural things. And that has been the challenge. What if that child is rejected and we have to live with that child? But we know there's a need in that community for people who have whatever other small diseases we could take care of. Mm-hmm. You know, does it mean moving to that community, living their lives, and trying to help them overcome this? I think someone had a hand up here. Yes.
I just wanted to give a little example. I am adjunct faculty in a small Mennonite college, and it is a very beautiful little campus right in one of the worst neighborhoods in the community. And many of the faculty live in that community by choice. The students all are required to participate in the schools in that neighborhood, and they do. They have afternoon programs for the community, and I think that it's, you know, very, very positive. I've been very impressed by that.
Because one of the things that we tend to forget is that the people we're trying to serve are very intelligent. They can see. They can see us drive past their neighborhood to our neighborhood. And then we want them to come to our church. Mm-hmm. You know? What do we have in common there? We don't live there. Mm-hmm. You know? We can't say this is our community. We can't say this is our neighbor. And I've seen churches struggle to reach people in other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And they struggle and struggle and struggle because they don't have the connection. How do we do that? You know, I think the Mennonite College is giving a good example of that. This idea of the town and down, you know, there's always this divide. Everywhere you go, there is, the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. You know, students who can afford to go to that school always come from far away. Mm-hmm. And students from around the community go to the community college that is local, that they can identify with. Many students don't even know where that college is because it's far out of their reach. That even it is physically far from them. And again, the same metaphor of culture. How do we bring them to be part of it? Can they speak our language? Can we speak their language, you know, metaphorically? Can we connect at that level? And I think we've got about 5 more minutes to do this. But I want to share with you a short story that puts this culture into a context of faith. A young migrant family came into town and wanted to find a church to go to. And they went to, they found this church that was about a block or two away because they didn't have a car. So they wanted a place where they could walk to. And the church was very happy. They had a very good family there. You know, they put together a lot of donations for the family. Family was very poor. They didn't have, you know, food, clothing, couches, just the basic things. And they responded quickly. And so the family started coming to church. You know, they became close to the pastor, and the pastor, you know, kept asking, "Oh, how are things going?" Well, we're doing well, but we still need this and need that and need that. And then after about 2 months, they came back to the pastor and said, "You know what? We don't think people in this church love us." Mm-hmm. And the pastor was shocked. "What do you mean they don't love you?" And then they said, "You know what? Every single family that has helped us, they have brought us couches, you know, the couches we sit on. They brought us clothes for our kids. They brought us food. But not a single one has come into our house to sit down and have a meal with us." And that says a lot about us. That we can give them. But can we sit down and eat that food with them in their house? You see, we are stepping away from our house into their house. We are under their rules in the house. A simple gesture like that is very hard for us as people of faith. To go into that little house, sit on that one couch, share with the family, probably sit on the floor and share a meal that we have brought. What does that say about connecting with people? We have time for a few more questions and comments before we close the session.
I think you just changed the bar amazingly when you said, how far is one willing to go for Christ?
Yeah.
Because, you know, how far is one willing to go to bring Doctors Without Borders or medical care? But when, like this gentleman said, when you introduce the concept of bringing Christ to a different culture, introducing a belief system to a different culture, I think we need like a whole other session on that.
Yes.
Oh, it's a reminder of a teacher who once showed that Jesus did much more receiving hospitality than you never hear Jesus inviting people over to his house.
Mm-hmm.
He's always receiving.
Yes.
Hospitality.
Yes.
And that's the thing, when we receive hospitality, we're saying these people are equal with us.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We don't have power over them that we can give them.
Yes.
We're saying, we're with you.
Mm-hmm.
And in this whole discussion of culture, it's so hard from within the culture without having someone from a different culture or tell you about differences or visiting someplace else and seeing differences firsthand. It's like, you know, it's the air you breathe. You don't notice it. It's just the way things are. It's how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a discussion of cultural competency recently, and someone had a list of things that they had developed to help exchange students have a better experience while they were in the United States, because in this particular program, the person had noticed that the exchange students would arrive, they were in love with America and everything American, and they loved all the Americans they met, and 6 months later they were just, "These people, what is wrong with these people?" You know, and he just came up with this list of 12 or 20, whatever it was, things that are commonly shared in American culture that are not the norm in 80% of the world. And because it's our culture, and we have all the other superiority complex things that go on, but, you know, we have to stop and realize that there's not just the one way, that individualism is not the end-all and be-all of human existence. Yes. And a variety of other...
And in living here at this village, I've been here, this is my second day, but I can tell you, this is what human life is meant to be. Mm-hmm. That you can actually rely on each other. You could take turns to do chores for the common good without competing, you know, to who has the best. You know, we all eat together, the same food. You don't realize what a paradigm shift this is. Mm-hmm. Right now, in American families, the statistics show that people not only not eat together, mm-hmm. but they eat different foods.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is somebody eating lasagna in the same house this dinner? Somebody who wants a cheeseburger, somebody who wants something else.
Macaroni and cheese.
Yes, they eat different meals in the same house. You know, so this is a very different. I don't know. I mean, the story that. Dan told about was it not Sylvia who was baptized?
Oh, Lorraine.
Lorraine. You know, Lorraine. I'm sure when we're leaving and going into the boat, we'll be a very changed people because this is what it's supposed to be. We are social beings. You know, primarily we are social beings. We thrive when we are with other people, and this is. I hope this is something we can take to our communities. I think the last thing I wanted to mention here when you mentioned about giving is the idea, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this when we talk about faith-based development, is the idea of the Heifer Project. Mm-hmm. That is one idea that is so empowering, mm-hmm. that the person who is poor actually gives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You get the first heifer, and it gives birth, and then you give someone else the offspring of that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing as empowering as having something to give someone else, yeah. because they are indebted to you. Mm-hmm. You know? And we always are giving other people. Because receiving means we are below them. We don't want to receive. You know? A lot of times, people don't want free things. So, I think that's a beautiful idea that somebody can give something you know when they need.
And that's a cultural thing, too.
Yes.
The potlatch culture of the Northwest Coast has a very different understanding of receiving, of giving and receiving. It's you know, there's the reverse, yeah.
I think our time is up. We will meet again in some time. Thank you very much.